Testing, testing. This is a little preface here for this taped edition. This is tape one. Libby's Monument. And this preface is just for this particular taping, which is being solely done so that I can listen to this piece of work instead of having to grub through the only existing copy, which consists of the original typescript. And I'm going to do this a little differently than I do most of the tapes. For one thing, this little preface is kind of necessary, so I'm going to go on with it. But I'm going to state in front that it's right now, it's April 19th, 1999, and it just turned 9:07 p.m., if that matters. Just want to have this, like, there's so many dates and things in this following document that I just wanted to have that in front. This is also kind of like an odd time and an odd thing to be doing. I just finished putting Goblinhood Satyricon on tape and listening to it, and it's the first substantial piece of my own taping that I've listened to, and since it's 15 tapes long, that actually means something. I'd like to listen to it again, and that means something too. I've been wanting to read Libby's Monument again all month, and other work has intervened, including that. I was planning to put off taping Libby's Monument until certain matters are expedited. I'm in the middle of negotiations to get some sort of little edition of this one piece, Libby's Monument, together to sell or distribute otherwise at the ComFest coming up in June. I don't know if that'll, well, at the end of June, I don't know if there's going to be time for that or that will work or what. I'd like to think it will, because that ComFest will be perfect for this story, which isn't even a year old and won't even be quite a year old then. It'll be like as hot off the presses as my writing ever usually gets. But I don't want to wait. I'd like to review this story as often as I feel like, and again, there is only right now one copy, and it's a typescript, and it's got so much whiteout on it that the pages tend to get stick together. The story took me about 2 months to 2 weeks to write, and then a month to type, but I'm amazed that I got it typed in that. So instead of the usual I'm gonna go ahead and say copyright 1999 on this as I introduce it for each tape. But that's only like to be a hope. I hope it'll be this year. I hope things will go that way, because otherwise, well, I'll probably just settle for sitting on the top listening to this tape and, you know, not try to do anything with it if it's not going to work the way it ought to work. Which should be self-evident when this comes out, because it's that kind of piece. It's like, I didn't write it to have it sitting around on the shelf. I really did not this one. And I'm willing to wait with a lot of work. In fact, it seems necessary, but I don't think I should be waiting with stuff that people really do have some need to be seeing this. In fact, one of the people who ought to have read it had just passed away, and so I can't go on sitting on things this way and feel good about it. Finally, I'm getting to the end of this, and I'm going to get ready to start the piece. This is Goblin Hood reading it. Goblin Hood, the performance artist, of course. And it's just, that's it. You know, like, if you listen to this entire taping, you will realize how strange that is for once, compared to, like, how strange it usually is on these tapes. Just accept it. You know, it was the same way with Satyricon. Goblin Hood is performing this. There's no other way to look at it. And it's just, he's the one that's any good at this, and so he's the one that's doing it. That's what his creator would be saying, and that's what I'm saying right now. So, without further ado, as it becomes 9:11 p.m., on April 19th, a Monday night. Let's just go on. A note at the top of this typescript states that the story was written between July 16th, 1998, 3:05 a.m., and circa 5:30 a.m., July 28, 1998. There are no notes as to when the typescript was started and finished, but I can tell you that it was throughout August of 1998. Libby's Monument, A Dream Tale of Goblin Hood, by James Beattie, read by Goblin Hood. Prologue. It was hot, but it wasn't that hot, if you follow me. I mean, it was mid-July and the weather had been really humid and muggy for days. I was sleeping with an electric fan a foot away from my head. But when I woke up, I wasn't even sweating. I wasn't even all that uncomfortable, though the temperature indoors was some 80 degrees. There may be a particular reason why I was so cool. I bring all this up to show that Libby's Monument wasn't what I call a fever dream. Fever dreams are what I'm likely to get when I'm sleeping in such a way that my brain is probably overheated. The best example I can remember is my Dalai Lama dream from a little over 10 years ago. I'm sure of the date because I had that dream on the afternoon of the first day, Friday, of Comfest in 1988. Comfest, or the community festival, happens during every final weekend of June. Comfest 98 took place a little over 2.5 weeks ago today. Ergo, my Dalai Lama dream is more than a decade in the past, but I still remember it pretty clearly. It will be instructive if I tell what led up to that dream. A friend of mine, Harry Farkas, used to publish something called The Journal of Bizarre Occurrences and Ridiculous Deaths here in Columbus. These days, Harry's work can be found on the internet as part of a webzine called Art Bits at this address, http://innerart.com/art.bits, in case you're interested. Anyway, Harry's journal was a compilation of weird news items and photos, the first thing of its kind that I'd ever seen. This was long before the other paper even existed, I think, much less began
running Chuck Shepard's similar News of the Weird column. I was one of Harry's infrequent contributors of strange articles that I'd find in the papers. I felt like quite the news hawk, or at least news hound. Even if I wasn't actually writing the stuff, I was still sort of covering it, you know? I believe that I contributed the article On the Lookout for Lizard Man by Wayne Bissart, USA Today, 7/27/88, complete with maps of swamp creature sightings and a list of other creatures stalking USA folklore, which summarized the attributes of such folklore superstars as Bigfoot, the Jersey Devil, Champ, a New York Loch Ness monster of sorts, the Dover Demon, giant penguins, 10 feet tall near Clearwater, Florida, and the Wallowa Lake Monster. Goblin Hood was inactive at the time, publicly anyway, and so didn't make the list. Anyway, you can bet I was proud to help place such important facts a second time before the avid eyes of the public. That Lizard Man article can be found in Volume 5, 1989-90 edition of Harry's Journal, for which I designed and drew and lettered, complete with misspelling, the striking masthead. I believe the Phil Silvers / Dalai Lama story was on the front page of the 1988 edition of the Journal, though I can no longer locate my copy of the issue itself. If I turn out to be too far wrong, I'll toss in a footnote at the end of this document. If I remember this story aright, it went like this. Somebody had been arrested in Tibet, I think, for wearing a t-shirt sporting the image of Phil Silvers. The authorities mistook the image for a picture of the Dalai Lama, whose image one evidently wasn't allowed to wear on a t-shirt thereabouts. The article included photos of both Silvers and the Dalai Lama, which alone were a million laughs, given the context. I must have been reading the article not long before I fell asleep on that fateful Friday of so long ago. I was sleeping in the upstairs front room of my apartment, close to the floor, with my scalp pointed west. Most of the room's windows face west, where the sun goes down like thunder through my orange curtains, making the room seem to feel warm even in the dead of winter. Whereas this was a hot June day, that orange light and the room's bright blue carpet make the place in the late afternoon seem like a pulp version of Mars, circa early Ray Bradbury. I was taking an afternoon nap on that Friday, and I didn't even have the curtains drawn. So the bright, direct sunlight was just pelting on in. I woke up after an hour or two, covered in sweat, feeling as if my brain were broiling inside my skull. I just dreamed of a woman vacationing with her dogs in Tibet. I think there were maybe 21 of the dogs, and I seem to remember them looking like miniature Alaskan huskies or something. In my dream, the dogs had all gotten themselves arrested for committing a political crime. Their odd activity had seemed entirely volitional and perfectly coordinated, but Don't forget about that famous bunch of monkeys typing for a million years and coming up with the complete works of Shakespeare. The dogs may have been totally random and thus totally innocent in their behavior. But here's what those canine cut-ups had done. They'd all lain down on the ground in the shape of the Dalai Lama's face, forming a kind of line drawing made of dogs, which was perfectly rendered from the photo in Harry's journal. The dream mostly concerned itself with their trial and its aftermath. I seemed to be reading about it in a newspaper article, I think, complete with a really gorgeous photo of the dog's Dali-esque and Dali-esque and Kafka-esque political faux pas. Obviously, the local dream authorities were trained to spot subversions rendered subliminally, according to Salvador Dali's famous paranoid critical method. Even when said renderings were committed by dogs, the trial itself, in any case, was right out of Kafka. In the end, all of the dogs were let go, except, sadly, for one which had to be taken out and shot. I think it had been convicted as the ringleader or whatever. At any rate, sadly again, none of the other dream dogs survived either after the broiling cataclysm which I called the act of waking up took place. But they survive here, don't they, in a way? And their ludicrous political statement lives on for whatever it's worth. And that's sort of the whole point of this essay, to memorialize someone in the following pages who was greatly important in my life, and though more obliquely, in Goblinhood's life as well. My Dalai Lama dream, of course, might seem pretty far off the subject for a document about a dream concerning a monument to my late friend Libby Gregory. But in fact, the proceeding is germane in many ways. In the first place, Harry Farkas, publisher of that journal, may have first introduced me to Libby way back when, or I may have simply met her at Comfest, though that seems less likely. Comfest, too, comes into this story again and again, so much so that the Comfest program for 1998 will hereafter be oft referred to and even quoted from. But most importantly, the Dalai Lama dream and its build-up sort of exemplify, in capsule version, the form in which the present document is being written, except that this prologue, if things go as usual, will probably be 3 or 4 times longer than the account of the dream itself. I use the build-up in these dream documentaries of mine to shed light on various aspects of my work as an artist, particularly those aspects which involve my performance art / intermediate creation, Goblinhood. This current offering is no exception. The basic idea here is that it would be nice if you, the hypothetical reader, could understand, or at least know, as much as possible about the background of the dream that I'm recounting, even if you don't happen to know much about Columbus, Ohio, the general setting, for instance, of the dream I call Libby's Monument. This way, if you all ever give me the Nobel Prize for Literature based on one of these little gems, I'll know you were at least aware of what you were rewarding me for, or anyway, conversant with the gist of it, and that I didn't get the prize just because you're all scared of goblinhood or anything like that. Though that would be all right too, I guess. I mean, I'd gladly take the prize on that basis. But there really isn't any need to be all that scared of goblinhood, whose bark would be much worse than his bite if he was into either barking or biting, which, of course, he isn't. So stop being such a bunch of wimps about it, okay? Speaking of goblinhood, his complex participation in the Libby's Monument dream won't make much sense without some prior explanation. It might not make a whole hell of a lot of sense anyway, but then being sensible was never exactly his strong suit. Clearly, though, it's greatly to the benefit of you, all my very hypothetical readers, that I should provide as much goblinhood info as possible, lest ye find yourselves swamped in the dismal backwaters of ignorance. So let's batten down the hatches and get on with it, mateys. Last one to the bottom of the page gets to walk the plank. Meanwhile, in documenting my dreams this way, I myself often learn new information about my work, both by thinking more carefully about it and by stealing subconscious fire from the gods, as it were. And in any case, it's a good way to codify and disseminate various art historical facts about such creations of mine as goblinhood. For that matter, goblinhood qualifies by now as an artificial life form in my book, which makes writing about him a matter of scientific research, and hence makes such writing my solemn duty to science and to the furtherance of human knowledge. Do I smell another Nobel Prize waiting in the wings? After all, in addition to being goblinhood, whenever I wear his mask, I also function as the proud father of goblinhood, which makes me a sort of benevolent Dr. Frankenstein, conscientiously writing up my findings on my hand-reared monster and documenting its harmless progress in the world. I'm also a bit like Dr. Jekyll writing about Mr. Hyde, except that, ironically, the fearsome-looking goblinhood is probably a much nicer person, on the whole, than I usually am. A little something that I've learned, as I said, from writing about this stuff so much. For one thing, goblinhood tries harder to be amiable, to offset people's sometimes negative reactions to his mask, to the mask. For the same reason, he seldom forgets himself, even in his cups, so to speak, as I and most other real humans are sometimes wont to do. In addition to documenting my dreams and to yammering about my work, such essays as this one sometimes attempt to describe and to study various aspects of the dream phenomenon itself, hence my discussion of so-called fever dreams, not to be confused with real fever. Thus I can speculate that I may have felt relatively cool when I woke up from the Libby's Monument dream, because that dream's climax, for whatever reasons, had a lot of ice in it. The location, too, of that climax was certainly even more remote from here than Antarctica would be, though that wouldn't necessarily have lowered the temperature any, I guess. Hell, for that matter, even the ice wasn't all that cold. As it happens, in any case, I can attest to one physical circumstance that undoubtedly influenced the Libby's Monument dream. Though I usually don't sleep on my sides, this time I woke up from the dream lying on my right side, with my right elbow and forearm supporting the pillow under my head. But neither my elbow nor my arm were asleep, as it's called, from lack of circulation. So I couldn't have been sleeping that way for very long, just long enough for my elbow to play a conspicuous part in the dream's denouement. The aforementioned Dalai Lama dream, meanwhile, illustrates something else of importance, which is the degree to which a dream prologue such as this one will be rooted in reality. If you stipulate that dreams themselves are real experiences of a sort, then none of what I'm writing here is fiction. On the other hand, things can get mighty distorted when filtered through the dream logic of the unconscious mind. So the version of Libby Gregory that I dreamed about bore very little resemblance to the real Libby Gregory that I knew and worked with for many years. With an eye to that, this lengthy prologue is partly a way of presenting what I knew of the real Libby Gregory, as opposed to the Libby of my dream. This preface material is my true monument to her. The Libby that I dreamed about was more like Phil Silvers than she was like the Dalai Lama. Though not a buffoon, a la Sergeant Bilko, she was kind of on the down-to-earth side. But the real Libby leaned more to the sage end of that spectrum for me, because I remember her as a wise mentor of sorts in my life, and as someone that I looked up to and learned from. In the end, Libby Gregory was undoubtedly a many-faceted person, a complex human being, and I fear I never got to know her very well in that sense. But then I'm not particularly good at getting to know people very well. She was nevertheless a vital presence to me, and I really miss seeing her around Comfest, for instance, since her tragic death in an airplane accident in late 1990, I think it was. Goblinhood, meanwhile, reveres Libby as one of the earliest facilitators of parts of my work that have helped put him where he is today, or even helped make his existence possible at all, in some ways. Certainly he owes some of his luxurious status as a cartoon character in the Free Press to the work that I did with Libby. My Libby's Monument dream may well have been largely composed and communicated to me by Goblinhood across the gulfs of my sleeping mind. It sounds like the sort of thing he'd come up with. He's got a kind of earthly, vulgar streak to him, sort of like Phil Silvers, as portrayed by a dog wearing a Dalai Lama t-shirt, is our friend Goblinhood. Besides, there's no question at all that Goblinhood was definitely mixed up with this particular dream, and even more pointedly so than he usually is. So yeah, he may very well have deliberately caused me to dream about Libby after so many years, for whatever his reasons were. I wouldn't put any such thing past him. And as for the dream version of goblinhood, who knows what such an entity might or might not be capable of. Author's note. As I write this, it's now Monday afternoon, some 5 days since that last sentence was written. In the interim, I've written up the dream story itself, which alone took a couple of long days, but which I felt that I had to get down while I could remember it. Usually, I try to do the whole thing, both sections, between sleeps, even if it means working long hours indeed, for fear of having a new dream drive the old one from my mind, or from fear of having my mind change so radically that I won't even finish the project. But this time it just wasn't possible to do it that way. For one thing, this time the dream part of the story turned out to be longer in manuscript form than any of my other similar essays were in their entirety. Hence, if this prologue is even going to be twice as long as the dream, let alone the usual ratio, I have my work cut out for me, but then there is a lot of ground to cover. Of course, you readers don't have to know this, though it does help to explain how these things get written. And I may even drop this note when I type things up, but I may keep it too to explain such discrepancies as the one I just mentioned concerning length. We'll see. Typists know. Many days later, it turns out that I'm keeping the above, obviously, because it also explains away certain minor redundancies existing between the two parts of this narrative, to wit, the dream tale in its breezy narration barely touches upon certain facts which will have to be more thoroughly explored and illuminated within this prologue. And rather than meddle with the fairly coherent exposition of the dream, I'm offering this little caveat in advance, always assuming that I don't wind up heavily revising the dream part when I get to it anyway, in which case, never mind. If all this seems a little ass backward to you, then why don't you just hold the thing up to the mirror and read it backward. In other words, it's my story, and I'll write it however I want to. This little note, for instance, is about as much fun as I get to have as a typist. And besides, that last parenthetical comment would really tell you something germane to this, if you were in a better position to hear it. Both of these little quasi-editorial interjections, in fact, go a long way toward illustrating something which comes up extensively later on, what could be described as Goblinhood's Yesterday People Revisited monologue. When you get to that little discussion, remember the sometimes snide yapping of the strange little ad hoc committee represented on this page, so separated in both time and temperament from one another, and spare a thought for us from your lofty vantage point so many pages in the future, or just start reading backwards from there for all it matters to me. Hell, I'm only the typist. Strictly speaking, most of what follows isn't even my work, except in this lowly capacity, if you follow me. But this is, anyway. Meanwhile, said the person who originally wrote all this, something struck me in reading over this manuscript so far. I talked earlier about how dreams are sort of factual experiences, but how everything in them is distorted to our normal eyes when the surrealism of subconscious thought comes into play. But human memory can distort things almost as badly, especially when the memory involved is as faulty as mine is. So, while this prologue material is intended and offered as straight-up factual journalism, keep in mind that it spans an entire quarter of a century, and that I'm only giving you my subjective view on things anyway. So don't be surprised if this reads more like a personal memoir than anything else. Recall, too, my uncertainty concerning the exact date of that Phil Silver's Dalai Lama article. It's possible that both sections of this essay will be followed by a series of footnotes, half again as long as the essay itself, which would be exactly what I deserve for trying to do anything at all, with my facts as shaky as they are. But Goblinhood doesn't give a damn for facts, just results, and he wants this written before I do anything else. So it's a case of needs must, as they say, when the devil drives, which could practically be my motto, I guess, when I'm dealing with Goblinhood. On the other hand, you should see the motto he probably has to describe his dealings with me. As if to prove all this about uncertain data, I'm going to hark back now to my earliest memories of my friend, Libby Gregory, whom I mostly knew as an editor, or at least a staff member, of the Columbus Free Press. I've already stated that I don't remember when or how I met Libby. Curse memory for being such a leaky vessel. But there you go. What did I tell you? It had to have been at least 25 years ago, I think. It would be awfully neat if I could at least unequivocally say when I first worked with Libby Gregory, but I can't even do that. And it's not entirely my fault, he whined, because of the circumstances under which we were sort of having to work. A classic case of needs must when the devil drives. I hold in my hands a crumbling chunk of newsprint from yesteryear. It's called the Columbus Free Press and Cowtown Times, Volume 3, Number 19, issue 51, April 11th to April 24th, 1973. For what it's worth, the newspaper cost 20 cents at the time. The headline on the front cover reads, "Suspected traffic offender executed." Inside, the related story by Houston Fearless sports two more headlines. "Annual spring police thrill killing," and "Off-duty cop snuffs youth," which pretty much sums the story up, except to mention that the cop involved claimed that his gun went off by accident while he was frisking the suspect, apparently with his gun against the guy's head. Back to the cover, a drawing beneath the headline depicts, in black and blue ink, an off-duty cop blowing a guy's brains out and simultaneously excusing himself, as if all he were doing was breaking wind or something. Well, it may have been an accident. This grisly and rather clumsy picture was drawn by me, my first free press cover, one of about three, I think, all told. I really enjoyed doing that cover because it made me feel like a real underground cartoonist. I was heavily into underground comics at the time, so the drawing I did was strongly influenced by Robert Crumb and others. I'd even met, by this time, some real cartoonists of the underground genre, most notably Justin Green, creator of Binky Brown, Rowdy Nudie, Classics Crucified, et al. Generally speaking, I wanted to become a part of that scene because I mostly respected what those artists were doing, but I must admit that it also looked like a way for a congenital outsider like myself to find some kind of a niche in life. It didn't work out that way, as it happens. But then the underground comics milieu has since become a sort of lost world itself, for the most part. Aside from the free press stuff, about the closest I got to really participating in all that was a small, locally published comic called Mindscapes, created by me and another artist, Bruce Sobel, in that same spring of 1973. In the true spirit of the underground tradition, Mindscapes was reputedly removed by police, or caused to be removed, or something of the sort, from some head shop in town, probably because of new and harsher obscenity laws, which came into effect right about then. But the apocryphal details remain hazy for me. The free press cover, in any case, was about as underground as anything could get, as witness the fact that I only signed it with my initials, JB. But then that was relatively straightforward, I guess, compared to Houston Fearless. In fact, all the names in the staff box were like that, or were simply enigmatic first names, real or otherwise. I think it was because we all feared police reprisals. These were the dark days of the Nixon regime, remember? Consequently, I can't find Libby's name anywhere in that issue of the paper, so I don't know whether she was involved with it then or not. But I seem to remember discussing that cover with her, and I'm pretty sure we discussed my few other contributions, including another cover, during that halcyon period of yore. I know that years later, when I began contributing fairly regular comic strips to the paper, Libby was the person whom I always submitted them to. And I know that on at least one occasion, at that point, Libby asked me for a specific drawing, an ink portrait rendered from a photograph that wasn't clear enough to print, sort of like old Civil War vintage daguerreotypes, rendered into engravings for newspaper publications during photography's infancy, I guess. There was a long hiatus between that early free press work and those later cartoons, during which I was mostly painting in a frenzied sort of fashion, and was, as is pretty normal for me, almost completely isolated and cut off from other people. I suppose I saw Libby during ComFest in those days, if I happened to remember about ComFest and wasn't too absorbed in my work to attend it. That isolation was born of alienation, among other things, and probably deserves some comment here. But this is no place for any comprehensive discussion of my emotional problems, except where they have to be brought into things. So I'll just say this. Libby was always kind and patient with me, which was probably why I was able to work with her at all. I think she may have recognized, or at least sensed, how mind-damaged I was, and still am, and so took care to make things as easy for me as possible. But regarding something like this, even a perfect and eidetic memory amounting to 2020 hindsight would be of little use. At any rate, I have to believe that she liked at least some of my work because of the amount of it that she helped to get published. Or maybe she was just humoring me. Christ, how would I know? Still, it seems more reasonable, more plausible, to assume that our working relationship was of mutual benefit in one way or another. And thus, through logical deduction, I explained to myself, in my benighted ignorance of the true hearts and minds of others, the mysterious workings of the world. Meanwhile, this is at least partly Goblin Hood's story, as it so it would no doubt behoove me to parallel this publishing info with a brief discussion of his antecedents, which began to emerge at roughly the same time as that free press cover I was just talking about. Back in spring of 1973, I was still attempting to finish my schooling, despite the aforementioned emotional problems which were rapidly turning me into a near total recluse. I first began experimenting with costumes while attending an intermedia class at OSU taught by a professor named Huebner. I can't adequately describe what intermedia meant in terms of the class I was taking. I can only describe what it's come to mean to me. My version of intermedia involves creating something which can transcend any particular medium. A cartoon character, for instance, who can also exist as the basis of a painting, or a story, or a play, or a film, or, as in the case of my masterpiece, Goblin Hood, who can actually run around in the flesh and participate out here in what we call reality. But Goblin Hood, as I hope all this will eventually show, is much more than a mere costume. And I guess, for me, it's that difference which is the whole point, of Intermedia. At any rate, after finally dropping out of school and holing up in various sleazy apartments to concentrate on painting, I continued to create various examples of wearable art. Most of these primitive offerings consisted of hand-painted jackets, some simple, some elaborate. One costume left over from that art class was merely a jumpsuit with its arms cut off and a couple of gaudy patches sewn onto it. Most of this stuff found its way into my paintings, associated with characters named things like Captain Face Happy, Above and Beyond, General Idea, and Private Hell. I suppose the quasi-military motif predominated because the effects involved could be created minimally by painting only a few areas of a jacket, for instance, with symbolic devices similar to the various insignia on a uniform. All of these creations were worn by me to some extent or another on the street. I should point out that a lot of this kind of thing was heavily influenced by my then obsessive reading of superhero comics, which I've nearly given up in recent years, partly due to lack of time and money to indulge in this pastime with, and partly, I think, because having Goblinhood around makes such four-color fantasies seem pale by comparison. In late 1978, I began experimenting with more comics of my own and created a character named Suitcase, based on a pet cat that I used to have named Weevil, and soon followed this with another character, the Cosmic Weevil, a sort of esoteric and metaphysical mentor to the more down-to-earth but super-powered Suitcase. Both characters were based on the same cat, perhaps suggesting the division between conscious and subconscious mind. For the most part, Suitcase and the Cosmic Weevil were satirical of various concepts in the superhero comics genre, comic book genre. These two became intermediate characters when I fashioned their images into handmade dolls, which I could carry around and brandish at will. And from this point on, the dolls began to take on a life of their own, in my mind, which probably marks the genesis of the Goblinhood phenomenon. After all, they were real, physical entities, affected by the real world, and sort of affecting it in turn. Of course, whatever spiritual life force they contain was originally invested in them by me, projected there consciously at first, and then increasingly subconsciously. My reasons for doing this, or for allowing this to happen, or whatever it is, might make good psychiatric fodder, but I prefer to take a more anthropological view of the situation, comparing these dolls to other spiritual fetish items, primitive or otherwise, such as the odd crucifix symbols so lavishly invested with spiritual meaning by certain cultures of the Western world. Shortly after this, I created a helmet of sorts out of an old plastic paint bucket, hand-painted with various heroic imagery and with a chess queen glued on top. A knight might have been more appropriate, but the queen simply happened to come to hand, and may have its own convoluted story to tell about the psychological significance of this fancy dress strain in my work, though it's nowhere near as simple as it looks. Unfortunately, or otherwise, we have no room for that convoluted story here. The helmet was combined with a fully painted armless jumpsuit and a jacket, also fully painted, and thus was the character Buckethead born, mostly to give the suitcase doll a real sidekick to hang out with. From this, you can see how these intermediate concepts were beginning to splurge out into the world of consensus reality that we all have to share. For instance, Buckethead and the Amazing Suitcase Doll got their photograph in the OSU Lantern, attending ComFest 1982. The photo was by Larry Breiterman and ran on page 3 of The Lantern, 5/24/82. My name was spelled Biapi. This Buckethead photo was later reprinted on the contents page of the 1998 ComFest program. And such reality incursions continue to this day. The latest issue of the magazine Columbus Monthly for August 1998 sports on page 13 a photo by John Patrick of Goblin Hood, identified only as the Masked Man, hanging around at ComFest 98. The mask is misidentified as being made of leather. My name isn't mentioned at all. But it's interesting that this weird and enigmatic image is all Goblin Hood really is to his largest audience, i.e., people who only see him around at random, from a distance, as in the enigmatic pages of Columbus Monthly. The first Buckethead suitcase cartoons were published in a periodical called Subversive Scholastic, circa 1980. In connection with this journalistic spree, Buckethead and the Suitcase Doll also made some of their first enigmatic public appearances, even being glimpsed on the local television news at one point. It was also mostly through working with this publication that I became associated with the North End Community Center, which used to exist at 5 West Northwood. Though I'd previously shown some paintings there, but however I originally got mixed up with the place, the fact remains that I painted a large indoor mural called Progress there during early summer of 1980. Obviously, this period was one of my more extroverted phases. Libby Gregory re-enters our story right after that mural, I guess, because the Free Press started running my cartoons later that summer and continued running them from then on for some time to come. It must have been late in 1981 when she asked me to do that portrait illustration I mentioned earlier, because I remember that I was feverishly working against a deadline at the time, finishing up the illustrations for a book called Nightmare for the Yesterday People and Other Illustrated Stories, which was published at the end of 1981 by Pond Publishing, affiliated with Subversive Scholastic, if I'm not mistaken. Another mural at the Community Center immediately followed in early 1982. The materials for Progress had been donated through private funding, but its new companion piece, Synchronauts, was painted with materials obtained through a grant from the Ohio Arts Council. In passing, Synchronauts, like the identically shaped Progress, was a triptych, following natural divisions of the walls themselves. Both murals were painted on recently constructed firewalls, two layers of drywall backed by metal I-beams, facing outward from either end of a long main hallway in the community center, which had originally been a school building. Each mural was, all told, approximately 14 feet tall by 17 feet wide, with the door kind of recessed in the middle, so that each triptych consisted of two tall panels, flanking a square panel over the door, each facing a stairwell. In a pinch, these walls could actually be disassembled without costing the triptychs much of their integrity. I mention all this technical data in connection with certain interesting events of a later day. Anyway, while Progress had been a general statement about the world and about Western civilization in particular, Synchronauts amounted to a convoluted artist's self-portrait. One panel of this mural, for instance, featured Buckethead and friends in all their glory. More significantly, however, this mural was also the spawning ground for a new intermediate character, an upstart by the name of Goblin Hood, whose life-size, full-length portrait presided over an entire panel of Synchronauts. Hence, Goblin Hood was made possible, in part, by a grant from the Ohio Arts Council. So thanks a lot, gang, from me, from Goblin Hood, and I'm so very sure, from the hapless rest of the world as well. This masked weirdo was obviously yet another takeoff on the comic book superhero tradition, and was probably even more directly informed by that motif than was his predecessor, Buckethead. But, unbeknownst to almost everybody, the strongest factor influencing Goblin Hood's creation was the 1980 David Lynch film, The Elephant Man, starring John Hurt as the horribly deformed and sometimes masked John Merrick. In fact, for a while, Goblin Hood was nicknamed the Elevator Man. But that is not a part of this story. The influence of that film is hard to explain. It's simplest to say that I was trying to externalize my profound sense of alienation from other people by finding a way to actually look as alien as I felt deep down inside. It worked, too. Just ask all the people who seem to get the terminal creeps whenever Goblin Hood is around. As for why I'd want to do that, I guess I took the view that if I was going to feel like a total outsider anyway, it would be more comfortable to have some tangible reason for feeling that way. And you know what? It is more comfortable, which is why I'm seldom seen out and about at all anymore, whereas Goblin Hood is always hanging around out there. But Goblin Hood was also conceived as an effort to take the intermedia concept further than I had before, I'd begun to realize that Buckethead could never get away, could never get very far beyond just being me in a costume, because he had my face. Whereas Goblinhood, anonymous looking as he is, his original mask was practically faceless and was basically just an abstractly painted canvas bag. He was free to develop his own personality, which of course he eventually managed to do, and which again was essentially the entire point of this challenging experiment in intermedia. One thing should probably be established here to the extent that it can be before we go on. It's been suggested on an amateur basis, God alone knows or cares what the professionals would say, that Goblinhood represents some kind of multiple personality disorder. I refute this on the grounds that I'm eventually aware of everything going on with his personality as it evolves, and that I'm ultimately in control of it, since I'm ultimately in control of him. I say eventually aware because it takes me time and reflection to recognize subtle developments, which, as I've noted, I often come to recognize during writings such as this one. Moreover, Goblinhood is something like any work of art that I consciously and deliberately put there, not something that developed behind my back, as it were, and against my will. Goblinhood represents more, not less, consciousness in my life. While he may be disorderly at times and in harmless ways, Goblinhood isn't a disorder. Which isn't to say that I myself am lacking in schizoid tendencies. I believe everybody has them to some extent, and that such tendencies are virtually inescapable in a world as multifaceted as this one is, among people whose minds are so divided and often self-deceived as those comprising the human race. All I'm saying is that Goblinhood is not overtly a function of schizophrenia itself, or at least no more so than any other form of artistic expression is. And my answer to psychiatric professionals who would like to take issue with my findings here is simply to say, oh, shut up, you pompous, overeducated, secretly schizzed out quacks, or I'll sick Goblinhood on you, and you won't like that. No, you won't like that at all. Even though he is perfectly harmless, you know. Or at least to the extent that perfect harmlessness can exist in an imperfect, unharmless world like this one. Anyway, back in 1982, Goblinhood was mostly just a mural painting, and a costume, and a desire to do some further research and development along these lines. His tangible escapades of the period were pretty minimal, and none too successful. And his other intermediate existence was mostly limited to an appearance of sorts in Citizen Payne and Other Illustrated Poetry, another little book by me, issued in 1982 by Pond Publishing. And Goblinhood would remain dormant, for the most part, until around 1990, when his current mask would be designed. The original mask was too bulky and uncomfortable, in addition to its not having enough to say as an artistic statement. In contrast, the spider on Goblin Hood's present mask is a reminder that creepy-looking things, like spiders and like Goblin Hood, can sometimes turn out to be mostly harmless or even useful, like spiders who control the insect population for us, and like Goblin Hood, who uses the Martian harmlessness sigil on his mask's forehead to accomplish all kinds of useful things, depending on how you define useful. At any rate, the formless mask of Goblin Hood's infancy soon yielded to an undistinguished and experimental maskless Goblin Hood period, which didn't work either for reasons already stated. So this was a difficult passage for the poor, hapless gobster. His awkward age lasted for 8 years. One big problem for Goblin Hood back in 1982 was the fact that he was completely overshadowed by his John the Baptist surrogate, Buckethead, who was by then a well-established and happening character, as witness that OSU lantern photo. In many ways, Buckethead was a hard act for Goblin Hood to follow. The strongest link between these two bozos was, of course, Suitcase, who was far and away the most happening character of them all. When I was painting Synchronauts, there were two community center volunteers who were of great help to me in various ways. One of these was Bill Finzel, still a familiar figure around ComFest, usually helping to organize things like the cleanup operation. The other was Mark Maselli, among other things, a local playwright. Mark is no longer with us. He was stricken down by some illness a few years back, only to join, for me, an ever-growing legion of spiritual presences that still attend ComFest in absentia, as it were. Some of Mark's observations still haunt me to this day. For instance, the last time I remember seeing Mark at ComFest, he said something like this: "It doesn't seem like ComFest without Lil around. Seeing her dancing to these bands was always sort of emblematic of ComFest to me." "Huh?" said I, the dull-witted, out-of-it, self-absorbed fool. "Yeah, you're right, Mark. So where is Lil?" It turned out that Lil, a mutual friend, had herself been stricken down by some illness without my knowing it, which wasn't, of course, the happiest news to receive at the time, but it did cause me to start noticing not only the people who were still at ComFest, but also those who weren't, as time, the relentless predator, stalks us all. Mark said something to me during the Synchronauts project, which has also stayed with me and caused a lot of pondering on my part. We were discussing my work in general, ranging at that time from would-be uplifting paintings such as Arenas to viciously morbid and sardonic paintings such as Beatty's Inferno. Ironically, both were started and mostly finished simultaneously back in 1976. Anyway, Mark commented that he could understand the existence of those pieces, which even at their best seemed fully consistent with my gloomy personality. What he couldn't understand was suitcase. Where did that concept come from? I didn't know either, and still don't. The whole suitcase motif seems way too cheerful, amiable, likable, and, well, viewer-friendly for me to have had anything to do with. But it demonstrates, I guess, that artistic pursuits can give us the means and opportunity to know ourselves even better than we would have thought possible, to find things within us that we'd never have dreamed were there. So I guess I can thank my late friend, Mark Maselli, for that insight. By now it seems, from the evidence, that people probably liked Buckethead, on the whole, better than they like Goblinhood, which isn't too surprising, considering that Buckethead at least had what people normally think of as a face, and seemed all told, and probably was all told, more human than his masked successor. But both of these illustrious personages could, I believe, have spent my entire career off somewhere playing cards together or something without being too greatly missed. Whereas Suitcase managed fairly early on to actually achieve a kind of popularity, at least among those people familiar with my work. For that matter, I truly believe that virtually everybody, except for a few true believers, would have gladly settled for Suitcase a long time ago, if that could have spared the world the awful specter of Goblinhood. But of course it couldn't have, so dream on, you poor saps, and blame it all on the Ohio Arts Council if you want to. In addition to Subversive Scholastic and other publications, the Suitcase Milieu was also prominently featured in Paul Volcker's now legendary comics journal Comic Relief, whose three issues were published circa early in 1981. This bravura offering, an all-comics newspaper, provided a welcome showcase for much local talent, and included comic strips by such notables as the painter Charles Wintz. Paul Volcker, meanwhile, was also the art director of the Free Press for some time, and so must deserve some credit for the most cordial reception accorded to Suitcase and Company in those pages. In addition, the original creation of Suitcase as a character may well have derived some partial, peripheral, or even subconscious inspiration from Paul Volcker's long-running Hero Dog strip in the Free Press, though the single strongest influence on the genesis of Suitcase was, oddly, the comic book titled Howard the Duck, then published by Marvel Comics, and particularly certain issues towards the very end of the Duck's first run as a color comic. In any case, Paul seemed to have more political activist savvy than I've mostly ever had, and so I often studied his work once Suitcase was out there, trying to figure out the right political tone to strike in working for the Free Press, with varying results, to be sure. I think the first Free Press Suitcase cartoon ran in the paper during August of 1980, and based on my file of back issues, such comics would continue to appear sporadically until circa late in 1984, after which I began another obsessive painting binge or something. For what it's worth, back issues of the Free are supposed to be on microfilm or microfiche or something at the Ohio Historical Society, believe it or not, in case anyone wants to try and look any of this up. The Suitcase comics sometimes featured Buckethead and sometimes featured the Cosmic Weevil and sometimes featured Frumper Room, about another former pet cat named Frumper, contemporary with Weevil, who hosted a talk show on TV and who had a suitcase-style secret identity named Staircase. None of these names really make much sense anymore, but then they probably never made that much sense to begin with. Other characters occasionally showcased in the free press for the uninitiated included the Acid Warriors, early champions of the drug wars, the Atomic Custard, a menacing paramilitary apocalyptic dessert confection, and a satirical superhero named Soup Can, whose civilian identity, Clerk Kettle, supposedly at one point had a newspaper job at the Columbus Free Press, and so on. Many of these characters of mine have weathered the newsprint fallow periods in my career by barging into my paintings, there to hang out with Suitcase as local color or something, though all such characters doubtless like to think of themselves as being in the position of substantially beefing up the ever-popular goblinhood Suitcase mythos. Well, let them think what they want. If nothing else, those early Free Press comics did manage to pave the way for the goblinhood Suitcase Cosmic Weevil Freep comics of later years, which goes a long way toward explaining Goblinhood's presumed attitude toward Libby. For as I said, most of this 1980s vintage work was originally submitted by me to Libby, the Freep's managing editor, I think, at that time, for publication in the paper. So I must have seen a lot of Libby off and on during those 4 years. But I only distinctly remember one long conversation, which took place at her home, her house, between Libby and, if I'm not misremembering, Buckethead. I don't remember what Buckethead was doing there, though I know that his tendency, as with Goblinhood, was always to go anywhere where he thought he could get away with it. And this time he apparently did. Nor do I remember exactly when this discussion took place, though it had to have been several years before the disaster at Chernobyl would shed its ghastly light on the topic at hand. But I remember that the two conversationalists were drinking coffee out of clear glass cups with white global maps embossed on the sides. Among other things, Buckethead and Libby were discussing nuclear war, nuclear power, and the superhero genre that Buckethead was so determined to insinuate himself into. In the course of this chat, Libby pointed out to Buckethead, apropos of what I'm no longer certain, how many comic book characters had gained their enviable superpowers from some kind of exposure to nuclear radiation. Good examples would be the Hulk, Spider-Man, and the mutant X-Men, all published by Marvel Comics. Though I doubt if she was usually this cynical about anything, Libby suggested, rightly I believe, that all this nuclear superhero stuff was typical wishful thinking on the part of American culture, certainly, and probably human culture as well, an attempt, conscious or otherwise, to foster the cheering illusion that the big nuclear mess we were making of our planet would turn out to miraculously help us instead of sending us all off to hell in a handbasket. It was certainly food for thought, particularly later after Chernobyl made its big nuclear mess. In connection with all this, it's perhaps cheering to reflect that neither Buckethead nor Goblin Hood nor any of my other characters, except for the sinister and egregious Atomic Custard itself, ever derived any of their mind-boggling superpowers from any source more dangerous than the pulsating power of insanity itself, or from sheer unadulterated chutzpah and force of personality, take your pick. Unless, of course, you want to count Goblin Hood's mysterious Martian affiliations. But cripes, who wants to count that unless we have to? Anyway, life went on and things changed, as they've a tendency to do. Late in 1982, the North End Community Center burned down, and the relatively unharmed Beatty murals had to be removed, partially framed, mostly through the tireless framing efforts of volunteer John Gurney, and stored in various places around town at various times. Their jolly romp out and about on the streets of Columbus comprises a sort of ludicrous but initially heroic epic which I have very little room for here, but many thanks are due to the volunteers who initially rescued the murals, to the Monkey's Retreat bookstore and other storage providers, and to everybody else who has helped with the endless mural saga over the years, about which I'll be saying more anon. Shortly after the fire, 12/5/82, I think, and the spectacular disassembly of the murals, volunteer Karen Waxman told the Columbus Dispatch, 12/23/82, page B4, that the murals were priceless and very historically significant. If nothing else, these white elephants, the murals, have by now gained the dubious historical significance of being among the most footloose and downright tenacious walls on record, while they give a whole new meaning to the phrase no fixed abode. Their capacity for survival seems sort of astonishing. They also, of course, enjoy the priceless historical significance of being the actual birthplace of Goblin Hood, the wandering site of his inception. But we mustn't hold that against them. At some point in 1986, Buckethead, the character, died of natural causes. His bucket fell apart, and that was it for him. The ghost of Buckethead was briefly heard from in a performance piece entitled Citizen Pain, a science fiction poetry opera, at Acme Art Company and other venues during spring of 1991. But these days, Buckethead exists only as a grisly relic called the Head of Buckethead, a styrofoam wig stand supporting the broken helmet over a paper mache Beatty mask. Requiescat in pace. Meanwhile, in late summer of 1986, the maskless version of Goblin Hood was first supposedly getting mixed up with interdimensional, quasi-Lovecraftian Martians. But that's another story for another time. And Comfest continued every year like clockwork. though like the murals, it was obliged to change its location more than once. I suppose that I saw Libby there when I was able to attend it. For the benefit of anyone who may be reading this in Timbuktu, I might as well explain a little about Comfest. It's sort of an annual 3-day celebration of alternative and countercultural values, entertainment and activism combined. It was recently described as follows. The Comfest now. It's been going on since 1972, getting bigger and bigger. But no matter how big it all gets, the values and traditions of it remain the same. Music, art, partying, consciousness raising, whatever. Those quotes are from an article on page 12 of the 1998 Comfest program. The article was entitled The Big Question and was written by me and illustrated with a snazzy drawing of Goblin Hood, Suitcase, and the Cosmic Weevil. Comfest is sometimes called Party with a Purpose, and I think people are talking about the consciousness-raising aspect when they call it that. But the big question you may be thinking right now is, just what does all this sort of peripheral stuff have to do with the late Libby Gregory? Well, Libby always seemed into consciousness raising to me. Recall her little nuclear summit meeting with Buckethead, and her work on the Freep would seem to demonstrate her commitment to various sorts of activism. And it's hard for me to attend Comfest these days without being reminded of her and feeling as though she somehow still exists in some way. Because all this Comfest stuff, this Comfest type stuff, is still going on. Besides, if you think this stuff is peripheral, wait till you see the rest of this prologue, which of necessity gets downright remote where Libby is concerned. Because what follows mostly has to do with Goblin Hood, his seeming attitude towards certain people, and the factors that I think led up to the dream I had about Libby, the dream called Libby's Monument, the dream this prologue exists only to shed light upon. So if you're reading this in order to find out stuff about Libby Gregory, then you've wasted your nickel, because I really don't know much more about her than I've already told you. But that doesn't mean there isn't more to say. I hope you'll